And this week, we're very happy to welcome Abhinav Deshpande, who's going to tell us about complexity phase diagrams. Please.
Thanks for the introduction, and thanks for inviting me here. So I'm going to be speaking about complexity phase diagrams today. But before we get into what they are, I want to give some motivation. So feel free to ask me questions during the talk also. Okay, so let's start. So first off, a lot of what we do in quantum computing and more broadly in quantum physics is interesting precisely because of this possibility that there's something outside of regular classical physics or classical computation that you can see. And so quantifying what this non-classicality is, or in other words, the quantum signal, is a worthy pursuit. And one way of quantifying non-classicality is by asking this question: when is a quantum system efficiently simulable classically? And when it's not, for example. And so this is a question that is in the domain of a field of computer science known as computational complexity theory, which allows us to draw classes like this and classify various problems into belonging to these classes. And so phrased in complexity theoretic language, for example, what we're asking is, what's inside the set of problems efficiently simulable on a quantum computer, which is BQP, but outside of BPP, the set of problems efficiently simulable on a classical computer? Okay. And this is a question that's both experimentally and theoretically interesting. First off, experimentally, if you understand, for example, where a particular experiment is classically simulable and where it's not, it can help you narrow down the space, the parameter space, where the experiment could yield some quantum speedup over classical computation. And so in this talk, I'd like to underscore that this is also theoretically interesting. And why would that be? That's because complexity theory is inherently a classification tool. And you might imagine that this gives you a way of characterizing non-classicality that's perhaps different from that of entanglement. And we have seen that entanglement has been pretty successful at classifying phases of matter, for example. And so in particular, you can tell whether a phase is gapped or gapless, whether a system's time evolution is inherently ergodic or not, and whether some ground state is topological or topologically trivial, all in terms of entanglement and how it grows in, say, space or time. Okay, so here's where we stand. So on one side, we have condensed matter, where we like to draw phase diagrams like this, and most questions involve classification. And on the other side, we have complexity theory, which gives us a tool for classification. So naturally, you might ask the question of whether complexity theory can help us classify phases by putting the two together and, say, drawing phase diagrams like this. And so here's just a cartoon of a kind of phase diagram you might want to draw. So on the x-axis is the evolution time, and on the y-axis is some sort of disorder. Let's say you have a disordered Hamiltonian. And you might imagine that if it's sufficiently disordered, then the system always remains easy to simulate in time. But maybe below a certain critical disorder, there's some time at which the system becomes classically hard to simulate. And okay, so that's just one cartoon of a phase diagram. Another phase diagram could be drawn if you're considering, say, equilibrium properties. And so when you're asking questions, for example, about the ground state, which is about like zero temperature in this axis, and some sort of strong coupling regime, you might have problems that are also quantumly hard to solve. So that would be a third kind of phase in this diagram. So we'd like to draw some sort of diagram like this for a hopefully interesting Hamiltonian. But before we get into that, I should elaborate on what it means to simulate a system. And there's two broad ways in which physicists speak about simulating physics. So for example, both these diagrams are from the same paper called Quantum Simulation. And so one, the first is dynamics, where one is interested in, say, preparing an initial state, evolving it in time, and measuring it in a certain basis. And the other is equilibrium, where you want to replicate certain properties of equilibrium states. So yeah, let me first focus on dynamics. And here's an outline of the talk. So I'll first be speaking about dynamics and then equilibrium and conclude. Where are there any questions here? Okay. So let me get to what defining simulation is. So simulation in the English sense is broadly to mimic something so that it's indistinguishable from it. And here's what we imagine. We imagine there's a referee who's looking at the output of, say, a classical computer and a quantum computer. And the classical computer is trying to mimic the quantum computer. And they're both producing outputs. And the referee cannot see who's producing these outputs, but has to distinguish which is which. So here's a very bird's eye view of what's going on in a quantum experiment. And so, for example, so we imagine that they both take an input. So the input is a description of the initial state that they start with, a description of the Hamiltonian, and the evolution time. And it turns out that these days, many modern quantum experiments end up sampling from some underlying probability distribution. So for example, if the state produced at the end of the evolution is just this uniform superposition over bit strings, then measuring it in the computational basis produces the uniform distribution. So the experiment ends up sampling from this distribution. And that's just denoted by DU distribution. So the classical computer has to replicate this experiment by producing samples from a similar distribution, say DO. And let's say that this is the space of all possible distributions. And the one we are interested in, DU, is a point in this space. And what we'd like is a distribution that's anywhere within some ball of radius epsilon around this ideal distribution. And the radius is measured in terms of variation distance between the distributions. So we say the problem of simulating or approximately sampling from DU is easy if there is a classical algorithm that takes some time polynomial in the number of, say, qubits or particles, and moreover has samples from any point within this ball such that this radius is inverse polynomially small in this number n. And furthermore, so on the flip side, we say that the problem is hard if it's not easy. Any questions so far?
Hi, I had a quick question.
Yeah.
I just wanted to check if when you say that when you're simulating, you're sampling from a distribution, are you by default talking about equilibrium?
Not necessarily, no. So for example, you can run your experiment for a fixed time, pause it there and just take
shots. Like a snapshot, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Yeah, in fact, what I have in mind is very much non-equilibrium in this first half of the talk, actually. Okay. So with that, this brings us to the idea of a dynamical phase transition, which I now explain. So let's say we have an initial state in the computational basis that starts off, say, in this all zero string in the computational basis. So the associated distribution is just this for 2 qubits, and that's obviously easy to sample from. But you might imagine that after some time t, the time evolution leads to some state that's a bit more complicated. And it may be hard in the limit of large number of qubits. And so for every function t of n, you can define a sampling problem. And this problem is either easy or hard. And here's a broad sketch of what might be going on. Let's say you start off in the set of easy to simulate states, simulate in the sense of approximate sampling. Time evolution can take you outside of this set at some point of time. And yeah, we are interested in what this time scale is. So what's the earliest time at which a system goes from easy to hard? And so this is a problem that can be defined for various classes of Hamiltonians. And you can then ask whether this quantity T star can be used to classify Hamiltonians. And this is what we are calling a dynamical phase transition, because as your system evolves in time, it goes from easy to hard at some fixed time or the time scale. And that's what makes it somewhat different from, say, regular notions of phase transitions in condensed matter physics. And yeah, I'll be coming to an example of this soon, but I can pause for questions here. Okay. So here's an example. So we have a system. We consider a system of bosons hopping on a lattice such that a boson can hop from, say, site J to site I with some hopping strength Jij, which can be time dependent in general. And furthermore, if there are two or more bosons on the same site, they have an interaction strength given by strength V. So this is the Hubbard interaction. So we imagine we have, say, n bosons in the system and a number of sites m that scales with the number of bosons in terms of n to the beta. And we imagine that the system is, say, a d-dimensional lattice. And we also assume that we start off with a sparse initial state, meaning that the bosons are kind of equally distributed and in the entire lattice. And that means that the interparticle separation between any two bosons in the beginning scales with n in this form. Okay. And we also allow for long range hops, meaning that a boson can jump from site J to site I, that's far away, that's like distance d away. But the strength of the hopping decays as a power law in the distance. And this power law exponent alpha is an important parameter in the problem. So when alpha is going to infinity, this just corresponds to bosons hopping from site to site, like nearest neighbor hopping. And conversely, when alpha is zero, there is no notion of locality at all in the system. So all sites are roughly equally far. And this intermediate case of finite alpha and the interaction strength V going to infinity actually maps to long range interacting spin systems. So in a nutshell, this Hamiltonian models several experiments, such as ultra-cold atoms hopping on an optical lattice, Rydberg atoms with van der Waals or dipole-dipole interactions, and ion traps. And okay, I'll quote my results now in the form of a phase diagram. So I fixed this parameter beta to be 2, which means that the number of sites scales as n squared. And I said, okay, the system lives in 2 dimensions. So that means, so this combination of parameters means that this interparticle separation scales as square root of n initially. And this is the phase diagram of the complexity. So what we have here is on the x-axis is the evolution time, parameterized in terms of the power of n. So all constant times appear here, for example, all times scaling with square root of n appear here, and so on. And on the y-axis, we have the power law exponent alpha, which governs how non-local a system is. So this corresponds to nearest neighbor interactions. And as you go along this axis, you become more and more non-local. So let's focus on this nearest neighbor case first. So one thing we see is that as long as the time scales sublinearly with the interparticle separation, the system is always easy to simulate. And that's expected because until this time, the bosons are just roughly hopping from one side to another, and they basically aren't even aware of other bosons existing in the system until this time. But moreover, what we can show is that this is also tight, almost actually. In the sense that as soon as the bosons start seeing each other, the system becomes hard to simulate. And yeah, so when your system becomes more and more non-local, the time scale at which the system remains easy to simulate, that goes down. And so does the time scale at which it provably becomes hard to simulate. So the true curve actually lies in between these two. And so for example, for any point in this white region, the system is either easy or hard. We just don't know which one it is because of some gap in our results. Any questions here?
I have a question.
Okay.
Please, could you repeat again which metric you use to quantify whether it's easy or hard?
Oh yeah. So the definition was that so when we say it's easy, there is a classical algorithm that probably can produce samples from a distribution with these two constraints. So the variation distance between the distributions is inverse polynomial in N, and so is the runtime, and the runtime of the algorithm is polynomial in N. So that's our definition of easy. And so, okay, the way we define hard is that it's not easy. So, but it's actually, in practice, it's usually difficult to argue for hardness because who knows, like maybe you haven't just been creative enough to come up with an algorithm, right? So the tools that we use here are that of reductions. So for example, all we end up doing is showing that this maps to another problem that we believe is hard to simulate for other reasons. And yeah, so there are some conjectures involved in when we say that something is hard, but yeah, that's just the life of a complexity theorist.
What do you mean by classical algorithms here? Do you have specific algorithms in mind?
Yeah, it could be any algorithm that runs on a classical computer. And so when we prove easiness, we end up giving a classic, we end up giving an algorithm to be run on a classical computer that provably has these properties.
Yeah, I mean, I'm asking because I could imagine that with the parameters you choose, you could like use exact diagonalization and time involved. I mean, the Schrodinger equation, right? So why would it be hard in that way?
Right, exact diagonalization would inherently scale pretty badly, because I mean the runtime, there's no way you can have runtime polynomial in N with that. So the algorithm that we do is just, it's actually pretty dumb. It's just pretends that there's no interference between bosons among various clusters. So it simulates each cluster independently. And that turns out to work well enough as long as you're in this phase.
I see, but I mean, is this phase diagram like a thermodynamic limit?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, well, because our definitions of easy and hard were necessarily asymptotic. Yeah, it's all about how things scale when n goes to infinity.
Okay. Yes.
Another question.
Mm-hmm.
So if we go back to the slide for easy hard definition,
yeah.
So the definition of epsilon here only involves the absolute value of the wave function, but not the phase.
Oh, no. So when I say PU, it's actually the probability of seeing a particular outcome X.
So it doesn't concern about the phase.
No, so the probability is a real number. So what P is a probability, and there's no phase there.
But for a quantum system, shouldn't we also be caring about phase?
Ah, okay. So that's what you mean. Right. So we are talking inherently about just probability distributions when you measure in the computational basis. And yes, that does ignore the phase there. But you could also talk about the sampling complexity when you'd say measure in a different basis. And yeah, so it depends on the class of Hamiltonians. For some classes of, say, circuits, it doesn't matter because if you're allowed to apply a single qubit rotations at the end of your circuit, then it doesn't matter which basis you're measuring in. But if you're restricting the class of operations you can do, then it does matter sometimes. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And am I right? For a system described by a fixed Hamiltonian, it might be more appropriate to include the phase.
Right. Yeah, I don't know how to think of that because we always talk about classes of Hamiltonians. Like in some sense, it's ill-defined to talk about complexity theory when you don't really have multiple instances.
You have multiple instances. I'm just saying you have a fixed Hamiltonian instead of a circuit that has single qubit unitaries. Because previously you said the phases will not be important if you have single qubit unitaries. But now suppose we just have a Hamiltonian.
Right, right. Yeah, it can matter. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah, sure.
I have a question about your phase diagram again.
Okay.
So I'm a bit confused about why when the time is long, the system is hard to simulate. Because when I think about that adiabatic theorem, right, where we suppose that the system always remain on the ground state when the time scales to the inverse of the gap squared, I mean, I would imagine that for a long time, you should be better shape than for short time. So how does that picture enter here?
One thing maybe to note is that the initial state it's not really an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. So I don't see why the adiabatic theorem would, you know, mean anything, because, like, for example, we could be starting off in some really high temperature sector of the Hamiltonian, and like we have no idea of how small the spectral gaps around this state are. But maybe another answer is that the way we have defined things is we look at worst case instances of Hamiltonians. And so notice that we have some time dependence here that we grant ourselves. And in particular, this time dependence could be chosen to be very diabolical, so that it foils any algorithm you might want to use, or any feature of, say, long time evolution that you want to use. I don't know which one makes you happier, but I hope they're both answers to your question.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. So let me move on. So we have a corollary related to this, and that is, if the system is Anderson localized, the system never gets hard to simulate, basically. And so in this case, we say that the transition timescale diverges. And so one might naturally ask about this notion of many body localization. And so we have some upcoming work for many body localized Hamiltonians in 1D on, say, n spins. And so this setting is not quite comparable to the previous setting of bosons. But if you just allow me to make a comparison for a moment, what we can show here is that the sampling is sort of quasi-easy if the evolution time is scales as some polynomial in N, and it can be any polynomial in N. And conversely, we show that as long as the evolution time is at least exponential in N to the delta, for any delta, this becomes hard. And just put another way, the sampling complexity can sort of detect the difference between Anderson localization and many body localization. Any questions here?
So is the easy algorithm just an MPS algorithm, or is it something more fancy?
The easy, you mean here?
Yeah, for the MPL.
It's mostly just an MPS algorithm, right?
And the hard part of the phase, which problem do you map that to establish that?
That's a good question. So there's actually an example of a 2D Hamiltonian, such that simulating the time evolution for constant time is hard. And this is actually a pretty surprising result if you think about it. So what we do is, like, we end up implementing that using this 1D MBL Hamiltonian, but implementing that takes exponential time.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, okay.
I have a question about thermalization here, because you mentioned that you are looking at out of equilibrium systems, right? But when you talk about now Anderson localization and MBL, I'm a bit confused about.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. When I speak about localized systems, I actually shifted. I was thinking about time independent Hamiltonians in this part.
I see. So I'm trying to understand. So you mean that to sample Anderson localized systems, by T infinity, do you mean now like your system is ergodic, quote unquote? I mean, your system has stabilized, you have equilibrium or something.
I don't think so.
Type average is equal to, Ansible averages, because that's another thing that I'm kind of confused, yeah.
Yeah, so what I mean here is that, okay, we are assured that the system is Anderson localized, and so this could be like a disorder dependent thing, but all we are assured is that for a given disorder realization, this has Anderson localization. And yeah, when I say T star is infinity, it basically just exploits the fact that that dynamical localization can remain valid for arbitrarily long times. I don't know if that helps.
Wait, what do you mean by dynamical localization? I mean, for the Anderson localization, you are always localized. Also, we have to tell us what is the dimension of the system, right?
Yeah. So this is, so that's why I mentioned this promise. Like, you could be 3D, but if you know that a particular disorder realization gives you Anderson localization, then it doesn't matter that you're in 3D, right?
I mean, it depends on the value of your disorder, right?
Yeah, what I'm assuming here is not just a value of the disorder. Yeah, because if you go from one realization to another disorder realization, things could change, right? The input to the problem is not just the value of the disorder, it's also like a particular configuration.
No, but the things that you have disorder averages, right?
Yeah. So I'm not taking the disorder average here.
And so what is so different between Anderson localization and MBL when you add interactions?
What is so different?
Yeah, why is that? There's a difference in the sampling complexity depending on the type of disorder, or disorder with interaction and disorder without interaction.
Yeah. Well, so one kind of explanation is just this, that if you look at, say, how entanglement grows in time for Anderson localization, it's observed to, always have this area law like behavior. But with MBL systems, if you just evolve it for a sufficiently long time, but say exponentially long, you will end up in an eventual volume law like entangled state. So that's like a probably hand wavy way of explaining this, because entanglement doesn't always correspond to complexity. But I'm just giving an analogy of where something similar happens.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So that actually concludes the first half of this talk, and I'd like to focus on equilibrium for the second half. And in particular, I'd like to talk about ground states. But the general picture to keep in mind is that we are interested in the task of simulating physics at some temperature T, and equilibrium physics now. And if the temperature is high enough, you might imagine that the system is easy to simulate because, let's say, like a subsystem thermalizes and it's well described, say, by the maximally mixed state, which is easy to sample from. So at the other extreme is that of ground states, which are sometimes even quantumly hard to simulate. And so this is what we'll focus on for the rest of the talk. So when it comes to ground state complexity, there's an entire field of study called Hamiltonian complexity that studies this problem. And one often considers this problem of finding the ground state energy of some local Hamiltonian to an additive error that scales as an inverse polynomial in the system size. And it was shown by Kitaev that this problem is QMA hard in general, which means, so QMA is actually the quantum generalization of NP, which means that it's likely intractable even for a quantum computer. And in the years since, this long line of work that tries to make these hardness results apply to more and more natural Hamiltonians. And so some examples of this are, if you give yourself constraints on how the Hamiltonian should look like, such as spatial locality or translation invariance, you can put those constraints and you can still get analogous hardness results. So an immediate question this raises is, how is nature finding these ground states if they're so hard to prepare? And so one thing that might be going on is that these hardness results mentioned here might be missing some structure present in natural Hamiltonians that they do not quite account for. So the first of these that I argue is the structure missed by these hardness results and actually significantly affects complexity is the spectral gap. So in physics, the spectral gap is obviously very important. For example, we know that a spectral gap above a ground state implies that the ground state has various nice properties, such as area laws, like entanglement area laws, and the existence of tensor network representations, and moreover, rigorous algorithms to find the ground state energy and other observables. And all of these things are proven in 1D. So the minimum spectral gap from the initial Hamiltonian to the final Hamiltonian in the adiabatic algorithm also determines the performance of the adiabatic algorithm. So on the other side though, in Hamiltonian complexity, we don't yet have a complete or clear understanding of the spectral gap. So for example, all we know is that existing techniques cannot give hard instances of the local Hamiltonian problem with constant spectral gaps. And even if you allow yourself to only consider gaps that scale inverse polynomially with the system size, we still don't have instances that are QMA hard. And so in this context, our work is another piece of evidence that the spectral gap makes the problem easier, but from the point of view of Hamiltonian complexity. Okay, our first main result is, say this, if we give a provable setting where the spectral gap is what affects the complexity. So we impose a sort of structure on the local Hamiltonian problem, and that structure is the spectral gap. So what the problem we focus on is to compute the ground state energy of some Hamiltonian whose gap is at least delta to an inverse exponential precision. And this setting of inverse exponential precision is the setting I spoke about. And it's admittedly a bit artificial, but nevertheless, it allows us to prove things. So this, it was known before that if you have no promise on what the spectral gap should be, and if you're just asked to compute the ground state energy of a Hamiltonian to inverse exponential precision, this problem is p-space complete. So p-space is a huge class that contains all these other classes. And so down here is BQP and P. So BQP is what we believe is efficiently computable in our world. And P space is all the way up here. So what we show is that the moment you add this promise that the spectral gap is at least an inverse polynomial, notice that it's not even a constant. It's still gapless in the way of as gaps go. Under this promise, this problem immediately becomes PP complete, so which is already much smaller than P space. So phrased another way, the spectral gap probably makes the problem easier in this setting. Well, probably is also, so there's a caveat associated with this because yeah, we have to assume that PP is not equal to P space, but everyone believes that. And so this also this caveat associated with it easier because it merely takes you from some very, very hard class to something that's merely very hard. But yeah, nevertheless, that doesn't deter us from hoping that it's true in general. Any questions here? Okay. If not, let me get to.
I guess actually, maybe just one.
Yeah.
Very vague question. Are mm-hmm. there stronger promises that give you even stronger complexity reductions?
Yeah, like, good question.
I mean, so, obviously there are like very nice techniques for computing the gaps of frustration-free Hamiltonians in certain dimensions, but if I promise that your Hamiltonian's frustration-free, does that give you something even stronger?
If you promise that the Hamiltonian is frustration-free, then yeah, I guess like the ground state energy is zero, so that's obviously easy to compute, right?
No, but the gap, I mean.
Yeah, so this the problem is not about computing the gap, it's just computing the ground state energy.
Right. So I guess maybe a follow-up question. Are there do these types of reductions also hold for promises about the gap? Like if I want to actually compute the gap and I promise that you're sorry, how do I want to phrase this?
Right. So you want to compute the spectral gap and you also want to promise that it's right. At least this much, right? Yeah, I suppose it
or could at least scale work. Certain mm-hmm. fast. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I see. I misunderstood what this letter is about.
No worries. Yeah, but that's also interesting.
And maybe one additional very big question: are there any classes of Hamiltonians for which there is a known worst case to average case reduction for the computation of the ground state energy?
Yeah, good question. I think, so p-space and pp are both classes that admit very natural average case hard problems. So, so both these problems, for example, are, you could probably straightforwardly construct average case hard classes of Hamiltonians.
But there are no results like that you know that exist. Is that right?
I would say it's there's nothing written out, but it's quite easy to come up with classes of Hamiltonians, I think.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So let me come to our second main result, which concerns another possible sort of structure you could add on to the problem. And that's the following. So you assume that there's a polynomial sized circuit to prepare the ground state. And we call this the low circuit complexity promise. And so we are again considering the same problem of computing the ground state energy of some delta gapped Hamiltonian to inverse exponential precision. And now, so when we are assured that the spectral gap is again at least an inverse polynomial, and we are given this extra promise that the ground state has low circuit complexity, the problem still remains PP complete. So again, phrased another way, this extra promise of low circuit complexity makes no difference at all if the spectral gap promise is already present. And so there's an interesting candidate explanation for the second result, namely that if you have an inverse polynomial spectral gap, it already implies that there's some polynomial size circuit to prepare, say, the ground state or the state of suitably low energy. And this conjecture implies that most natural ground states have short circuits to prepare them, and short in the sense of polynomial size. And why is that? Because, say, most natural Hamiltonians in my language are either gapped or, say, maybe describe, say, like a gapless phase where that's described by a CFT. And in those cases, the spectral gap also vanishes polynomially in the system size. And because you know that there is a polynomial size circuit to prepare the ground state, this explains why variational algorithms seem to be performing well. Because if the circuit exists and you search for it hard enough, you're bound to find it at some point. So this is like a prerequisite for variational algorithms to be doing well. Okay, so with that, I conclude. I'll conclude. So we've seen complexity as a way of classifying dynamics. And so we saw one sort of classification and a phase diagram here for long range Hamiltonians. And we also saw results for Anderson localized and MBL Hamiltonians. And yeah, we also looked at the complexity of equilibrium states, specifically ground states, and how the spectral gap affects the complexity. And this conjecture that I mentioned, if true, would sort of explain why variational algorithms like VQE perform so well. And in the future, I'd like to continue thinking about both classical and quantum algorithms for simulation, both in the sense of dynamics and equilibrium, and also more applications of complexity theory to physics, such as, say, entanglement phase transitions. And yeah, I'd like to think about other features of tractable Hamiltonians, like do constant gapped Hamiltonians have, say, area laws and tensor network descriptions, and so on. So I'd like to thank you for your attention and all my collaborators on some of these works, and particularly Alexei Goshkov and Bill Pfefferman, who are kind of my advisor and co-advisor respectively. Thanks.
Great. Thanks a lot, Abhinav, for the great talk. Let's do a Zoom round of applause. So we already had quite a few questions during the talk, but do we have any more questions?
I did have a question about the result two and the conjecture that you stated.
Yeah.
So in result two, if I remember correctly, you used the promise of an inverse polynomial spectral gap.
Right.
And in addition to that, a low circuit complexity, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then I don't understand, if you're already promising both of them, mm-hmm. why does that imply that an inverse polynomial spectral gap usually has a low circuit complexity?
Oh yeah, so it doesn't imply that. So that's why it's still a conjecture. But this conjecture is consistent with this previous result. In fact, the conjecture would imply the previous result.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. I see. Okay. Thank you.
Cool.
In the first part of the talk, it's possible I missed it, but did you talk about whether these transitions were always sharp?
Oh, yeah. So I don't know what you mean by sharp, but there's a sense you can define coarse and sharpness of the transition. Some of them are sharp, some aren't. So for example, interesting.
There's some exponent on either, like some exponent for divergence on either side that agrees.
The degrees, meaning like the degree of the polynomial.
Sorry, we'll say what you were going to say and then I'll ask.
Yeah. Okay. So there's one sense of sharpness or coarseness of the transition. And interestingly, it's similar to universality classes in the sense that what we see is that if the Hamiltonian is interacting and in, say, two or higher dimensions, then irrespective of the details of the interaction and so on, the transition is always sharp. And on the other hand, we see that if your Hamiltonian described free bosons instead of interacting bosons, or if you were in 1D, then the transition is coarse. But let me also define what I meant by sharp and coarse. So sharp and coarse just differ in terms of the behavior at the transition point. So if you have a time that's so sharp, a sharp transition would be something like this. So maybe it's simulable for time, say 2L, but not simulable for time 2.1L. That's an example of a sharp transition.
Mm.
On the other hand, for a coarse transition, maybe you have something like L to the 1 minus delta is easy, but anything that scales as L or larger is hard. So the difference is...
So I should think about a scaling with L on either side of the transition and whether or not, like, as I approach the transition, those scalings agree?
Uh-huh. Yeah. So in one case, the transition occurs in the exponent of the time scale, and in the other, it occurs in the prefactor.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Are there any further questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Abhinav again for the great talk. And I just want to announce that next week we'll have Ben Lovitz from the University of Waterloo.
Thank you.